Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show has come to you from Bristol City Centre and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. In case you hadn't noticed, I've got a little bit of a cold this week, so I do apologise for that in advance. Hello to everyone in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston and those all over the world, including South America, we're told, accessing the show on the internet. We have three studio guests this week. We're bulging with people. Four, in fact, if you include the Bard of Windmill Hill, who's also here to tell us a poem. Colin McNamee is from the UKIP party, and we're going to be speaking to him about the Somerset and Frome branch, which has been reorganised and restarted. We'll speak to Ali Zalmay, a journalist in the Kurdish region, or he was, of Iraq, and he's here to talk about the suppression of the press in that country and his experiences as a journalist. We also speak to Tim Moat from the Mission of Fishermen later in the show. We're hoping to link up again with the radio via the technology of the telephone to the Gaza convoy and see where they are in Europe. We spoke to them last week and they're somewhere around the Austrian border, so let's see where they are. Anthea Page visited the Bristol Interface Group Midwinter Festival of Light in Redland, which coincides with the 61st anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights. So we hear about that later on as well. And also the last part five of the mysterious death of Dr. David Kelly. Also, a bit of a Christmassy treat, Malcolm Greaves reads a ghost story. This week's John Carrington's Wedding Day by Edith Nesbit. I'm John Peters Coleman, and I'd like to welcome to the studio now Colin McNamee from the UKIP party. Hello.
Hello. Hi, John.
So tell us very briefly, for those who might be ignorant, but surely everybody must have heard of you, the United Kingdom Independence Party. What is it you exactly wish to remain independent from?
Well, the title really says it all. Independent from the European Union, part of Europe, obviously, geographically, and part of trading with them, but to be governed by those that we elect in Westminster, mm-hmm. and not to have laws imposed.
Okay. I mean, we do have European Union elections for members of the European Parliament. I mean, surely the European Parliament is just a parliament like any other.
No, actually, it's not a parliament. For a start, it doesn't have an opposition. You can't vote the European Parliament out. You can Westminster. Mm-hmm. So you can't get rid of the European Parliament. And the 27 commissioners are appointed. And they actually make the policy, which goes down into the parliament for the MEPs to discuss. Unlike Westminster, an MEP, if called, has between 40 and 60 seconds to make the point. That is it.
Okay, I mean, some people who, would not consider themselves to be a UKIP voter would just categorise you as being sort of small little Englanders with your Union Jacks out waving your flags and going, you know, we want bent bananas, we don't want your stupid regulations. Apart from some of the minor flaws that could be changed about the European Parliament, what's so bad about getting involved with Europe?
Okay, well, it's interesting, John, that you should raise bananas, because on the national news tonight, it was announced that the EU have agreed tariffs on the subject of bananas. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily straight or curved, but bananas. The discussion started in 1956, and this round of talks has gone on for 15 years. So an awful lot of bureaucracy, an awful lot of money, and the understanding is that the rules and regulations of the new tariffs are going to take 9 months to translate into 23 different languages. There's one thing to be against. What a load of gobbledygook.
Right. I understand that you used to be in the Conservative Party, and
that's right.
I was chatting to you as you sort of arrived earlier, and you said that you read the Maastricht Treaty back in 93 when it first came out. You said it took you 3 weeks to read. It's quite a hefty tome then, presumably.
No, it was just very complicated language. I mean, I could understand why Ken Clark, who was the minister responsible at the time, didn't read it. I also had to use a dictionary, and I persevered because I couldn't understand what all the fuss was about. As soon as I'd read it, I understood, and promptly resigned from the Conservative Party. Amongst many other things, the Maastricht Treaty subjects this country to regional governance. So county councils will eventually disappear, and there is no choice of whoever is in Westminster. We have to have regional governance. Now, regional assemblies are the Labour Party's interpretation of regional governance. So the Conservatives mm-hmm. can say, quite accurately, that they, and they are saying, they will do away with regional assemblies. Regional assemblies are unelected. They've taken power away from county councils, that getting involved in spatial planning activity. What the Conservatives are not saying having done away with regional assemblies, what are they going to replace them with? Maastricht Treaty commits us to regional governance.
Right. When you say regional assemblies, that to me, in layman, and most people are probably going to mean the regional assemblies that you have in, for example, Wales.
That is one of them, yes. The UK is going to be divided up, or is being divided up, into 12 areas. Four of the regional assemblies, with slightly different names at the moment, have already been established. Right, Northern Ireland, yeah. Wales, yeah. Scotland and London.
Right.
The remainder of England is to be divided up into 8 assemblies. We have, down here, the South West Regional Assembly.
OK, where's that?
Based in Exeter.
Right, not many people probably knew that. So what powers does it have at the moment?
Oh, huge powers and quite a big budget. There's been quite a movement. The Bishop of Exeter used to chair it until he was ousted out about 2 years ago.
Right.
Interesting combination there of how did the Church of England get involved into a political body and chairing an unelected body. But they are definitely taking planning permissions away from county councils. And they're deeply unpopular.
OK, so what do you think realistically could happen to Westminster? What role would it have anymore?
That's a very good question.
OK, so
virtually none. Because generally accepted, now it does vary, but the minimum figure is 70% of our laws and regulations emanate from Brussels. Now, some people are claiming 80 to 85%, but 70% come through what is, in effect, a regional government.
OK. So we've heard a little bit about how, you know, UKIP is not necessarily just about spreading scare stories. There are realistic concerns. But what would UKIP do about it if you were sort of in government? That would be possibly a little way off.
There is no chance at all UKIP forming a government. No chance at all.
But what do you propose to do?
But what can be done is to repeal the Treaty of Rome and the European Act, to take control back to Westminster. And a lot of people, and these are not scare stories, if you talk to, we are not anti-EU. We want to trade with the EU.
Right, and that's quite important.
Indeed. With the exception that it does inhibit our sales globally, our exports, and I used to be in export sales, right. And I did vote for the EEC in 77 or 75 to remain a member of it.
Okay, so that's quite a significant thing to say. You're not against Europe per se, it's specifically these treaties that are going to, you know, sort of dissolve quite a lot of our parliamentary structure.
Have already done so,
right.
And if you talk about exports, people say, who are pro-EU, that the majority of our exports depend on trade with the EU. Mm-hmm. Not true. 8% of the export figure goes to Antwerp and Rotterdam,
right,
for containerisation on the way to the rest of the world.
Right.
So it's round about 45-46% genuine to EU, and the balance, the greater, in other words, to the rest of the world. There are approximately 4 million jobs in the EU dependent on trade with the UK. There are 3 million jobs in the UK dependent on trade with the EU.
Right.
Our deficit balance at the moment with trade with the EU is £100 billion per annum.
Right.
Nobody's talking about a trade war. It'd be absolutely stupid. What we want to do is to sell to the rest of the world without being fettered.
Right, I'm going to change the subject a little bit because people might get the impression that UKIP is majoritively a right-wing sort of party, or is ex-right-wing. And you've got sort of branches here in Bristol and Somerset and Frome. What sort of members are making up this UKIP branches?
Somerton and Frome, we formed about 3 months ago. And the new branch in Bristol, the majority of the people leading that branch are ex-Labour and ex-Liberal Democrat. The majority of us in Somerton and Frome are actually ex-Conservative.
Okay.
But when I stood in East Devon in 2005, I had ex-Labour and ex-Lib Dem people out canvassing. The majority were ex-Conservative. But our candidate for Somerton and Frome, Barry Harding, used to work for the Department of Trade and Industry,
yeah,
advising one of the advisors to the government on EU treaties. He took early retirement in 95 because he was fed up with the sleaze that was going on.
Right, OK. OK, well, we've got to wrap up there, unfortunately, because we're running out of time. But it would be lovely to have you back, Mr. McNamee, and we'll just discuss this in more detail in the new year.
Thank you, John, and the name's still Colin. You'll find it easy to pronounce.
Thank you. Our next guest in the studio is Ali Zalmay, who's a journalist from the Kurdish region of Iraq. He was forced to flee for his life because of comments that he made about the regime. Hello.
Hello, hi.
How long have you been in the UK for now?
Actually, it's about 7 years.
Okay, and before that, you spent all of your life in Iraq?
I spent about 2.5 years in between. I don't know where.
Right, okay. Yeah, so you were sort of a lost soul for 2 years, trying to find your way to here.
That's right, yeah.
When did you first become a journalist? Was that sort of your calling?
It was about in my early 20s. I was interested in art, and in that time, actually, there wasn't a professional way to become a journalist because the situation in that time was difficult.
Yes.
There was a school of art and there was a school of journalism as well. But as I said, the political situation was difficult. So my journey to interest in journalism was not through the education or something like that. I did degree in literature.
So were the subjects that you could study quite limited under Saddam's regime? Were they sort of, these are the official subjects, so to speak?
Yeah. Actually, we have to back to that time and then to give a clear picture of what was the situation. Mm-hmm. Then we can discuss what we can discuss in particular problem. So in that time, when I became a journalist, say like that, as I said, we have to back to the wider context, which was two major wars. One is between Iran and Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Straight away after that, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait.
Yes.
And then, so as a result of those two wars, a huge impact of Iraqi's life, everything actually. So,
how old were you at the time?
I was in my mid 20s.
Okay.
Early 20s actually, yeah. So the war between Iraq and Iraq ended in August 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a couple of years, actually, big war started, what we call now First Gulf War.
Yeah.
And when Saddam invaded Kuwait, and then in that time, coalition force started another war with the Saddam Hussein. So I'm trying to say that in this situation,
mm-hmm.
it's everything is mixed and then it's awful.
Did you serve in? Were you conscripted to serve in the army at that time at all?
I didn't involve to any kind of army or military things like that. But after the invasion, there was uprising from the northern of Iraq, which is Kurdish people. And then from the southern, Shia people. So again, the central government, because the central government ruled by the Sunni minority in that time.
Yes.
So then when the uprising in 1991, and then a new era actually start, which is we attest a kind of a freedom, and we liberated from the central government. And then in that time, we're thinking of rebuilding a country, and also we're thinking of actually re-life, if that's a suitable term we use now.
Okay.
So yeah, in many fields. So I was, as a young person, actually, we are a group of people. We were thinking of publishing a new magazine and newspapers.
Yeah.
And then, this kind of stuff, yeah.
Okay, so how difficult was it to be a journalist in Iraq with Saddam ruling? What were there restrictions on what you could say?
Yeah, first of all, we have to say that actually under Saddam's regime, Kurdish, we were denied as a Kurdish people. So we were not allowed to speak in our mother tongue or in our first language. So I've been educated in Arabic language, for example.
Right,
so
okay.
I wasn't allowed to study and educate in my mother tongue, which is one of the fundamental human rights. Think about this kind of issue. So in the first place, we were not allowed thinking and speak in our language, actually. So how can you be the situation of journalists? In that time, actually, there was only one style of one model of journalism in Iraq, which was the state journalism, and this all come from the Ba'ath Party. And
so where were you when the what referred to as the Second Gulf War kind of toppled Saddam? Where were you at the time, and how did you feel about that?
Yeah, actually, I was in that time. I was in Syria. I was waiting for my wife and my small boy to join me, and then I was approaching to back to come to UK. Mm-hmm. And then, so I was in the border between Iraq and Syria, right. waiting for them in order just to get out from yeah. this.
How did you feel about the Americans sort of liberating Iraq, as they put it? Was that how you saw it?
Actually, it's very controversial thing. That's in one hand, yeah, of course, people from Iraq, they were appreciated what they happened to this regime, because we suffered from this regime. Actually, especially I am at the Kurdish, we were very badly treated in that time.
Yes.
So to fall in this regime, and then for us, it's kind of a dream come true. So that's the first thing.
So that's good side.
Yeah, good side. But the bad side, imagine for the ordinary life people. So what happened actually after the invasion? Mm-hmm. So Iraq slipped to the civil war. Iraq slipped to a kind of insurgency and culture of bombing everywhere, you know. So that's, of course, affects psychologically and physically as well of a lot of people's life in Iraq. So this side is, I mean, unacceptable by any.
Yes.
So it's a two-side of things, yeah.
What are you doing in the UK now? Are you still a journalist?
Actually, I do sometime write for some Kurdish newspaper. You know, we are living in the age of the communication, so easily to communicate with people. So, yeah, I will do contribute some articles, not as a freelancer. But mainly I'm concentrating on my study here. Actually, when I finish my study, a situation now changed, you know. Yeah. So probably I will back to Iraq, and then I start the journals as I preferred
before. And possibly go back to art?
Not really, no. Because I think art is kind of like an innocent area. And then my experience of, I was grew up with a bomb and the war. So I lost my what's called sensuality of art, things like that. So I more now
into the journalism.
Journalism and things like that.
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut you short, but it was really nice and very interesting to speak to you, Ali. Thank you very much for coming in and sharing your experiences.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Our last live guest in the studio, no, that's a lie, actually. We've still got the Bard of Windmill Hill later on. He's not our last guest. Our second to last guest, our penultimate guest, is Tim Mout, the regional organiser and organiser of the Mission of Fishmen. Hello.
Hi. It's actually the Fisherman's Mission, way around.
The Fisherman's Mission. The Fisherman's Mission.
Hi. Thank you very much. What do? Well, we try to meet human needs in the fishing communities in the name of Christ without discrimination.
Right.
That's what we're set up to do. Providing care and comfort, that's to say physical, spiritual and financial support and help around the country in the fishing communities. We have about 30 members of staff and volunteers based in the various ports, and our activities range from places like Brixham in Devon or Newlyn in Cornwall, where we have full-blown missions with accommodation, showers, food, that kind of thing, right through to bodies like myself operating in other areas of the country where we're calling around on the people who might be out there by the coast.
Right. With the fishing industry always sort of in a state of sort of panic and decline and having an awful lot of trouble, does that mean you find your work increasing or decreasing as the years go by?
It's not really panic, actually, John. There's about 13,000 fishermen in this country.
Okay.
And about 50,000 who are retired or on the beach.
Right.
And that's really because of our own ingenuity. A modern trawler catches just about 100 times as much fish as a boat with the same number of crew caught in 1950.
Right. So that's
it's quite staggering.
Yeah,
we are victims of our own ingenuity.
Okay, so do you wind up helping mostly retired or mostly sort of people who are in business who may be sort of struggling? Or
we help both, okay. And the sort of help we provide is really quite small. Perhaps up to about £500 in each case, and we helped in about 1,000 cases last year.
Okay. What drove you to help fishermen specifically out of all the communities?
We were bound so to do by our founder, Ebenezer Mather.
Well, that is a name, Ebenezer.
Isn't it? Yeah. Ebenezer, in 1881.
Okay.
Who bid us preach the word and heal the sick.
Yeah.
We are a non-denominational Christian mission, and we work with people all around our coast.
Okay, brilliant. Well, thank you very much for coming. And how can people get in touch with the mission, the Fisherman's Mission? Do you have a web presence?
Indeed, we do. Just type in Fisherman's Mission into Google, and you will find us.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for coming in, and that was very interesting to hear about it. That was quite interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Okay, Shakir, last week you were on the borders of Austria. Where are you now?
We're in Turkey.
Ah, brilliant. Good progress. How far across... have you just entered Turkey?
Yes, we were at the border about 9 o'clock, 9, 10 o'clock, and it took us about 3 hours to cross, and there was a big crowd waiting for us, live TV, national TV, well, it's actually international, and we had about 150 people waving flags and all Palestinian flags welcoming us, giving us fruit, and we've been all over the place. They've been feeding us now that we're in a, some sort of sport complex, and we will be staying here tonight, and in the morning there's breakfast, and there's sorts of things planned for the next few days.
Wow, that's a hell of a reception. What was that like? But what was it like the first time you you took a different route on the earlier trip, of course. I'm just because you went across North Africa, but how's that reception been compared to crossing Europe?
Oh, well, I didn't go on that trip. I actually came this way while they were going on that way.
Okay.
So we went to both. I'm the awkward one, so I took this route.
Yeah.
So, but I think everybody reckons this is better.
Oh, cool. Brilliant. Okay, well, what is the weather like at the moment? Has the weather been quite good
weather
to you?
Weather is mild, and I think it has been raining earlier. It's wet, but it's dry at the moment. And the weather is mild. It's not cold at all.
Okay. I mean, last week you had about, 70 plus, 70 or 80 vehicles. Have any more joined you en route?
We were, I think, 80 altogether. One of them had a crash yesterday in Greece.
Oh.
Some cement truck ran into the back of it.
Oh, are they okay?
A van from Gloucester. Yeah, no one was hurt, but the vehicle has been written off. So down to 79. And there's about 80 vehicles joining from Turkey. Then I think there's a 50 odd vehicle from American convoy,
mm-hmm.
and that thing.
Right.
So going bigger and bigger. I think when we go to Syria, there's going to be more people joining from there and from Jordan. Then I don't know how we're going to manage. Just going bigger.
I was going to say, because when I spoke to you last week, you mentioned that you had some organisational difficulties with getting people going in the morning, for example, it taking a very long time to get all 80 vehicles going. How is the organisation of so many people going?
Well, I mean, I think we've got used to it now. But I think everybody needs to get up tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock and breakfast, and everybody has to leave about 8 o'clock to go to some sort of reception again.
Okay. Who's organised that reception?
This is a Turkish organisation, IHH.
Right.
They have got a food trailer, a food truck, following people the other side of Turkey, the Syrian border. They're all going to be feed us.
Yeah.
And there'll probably be some sort of rallies going through towns and stuff.
Right.
I think there's one going in Istanbul.
Okay.
Place called Taksim.
Okay, who are the IHH? Who are they? What do they do?
Well, they're International Human Help or something. That's what they're called. They were, when that war was going on last year, they were actually one of the first lot to get in and help the people of Gaza. They're still helping. And they're still sending aid over there. And they're organising this Turkey leg of the journey.
Right. So you think you feel you're making good progress according to the schedule that you had roughly mapped out?
Yeah, it's good progress. I mean, it's everything on time, and we're just running smoothly.
Brilliant.
So good.
Do you think the reception in the Syria and Jordan will be different to what you've experienced so far? What are you expecting?
I don't know. I mean, we thought we were going to have loads of war welcome in Europe, and we didn't really. We just had a few people in Belgium, and we're supposed to meet some people in Italy, but so far we did not see anybody in Italy.
Okay.
And so Greece was good.
So finally, where do you reckon you'll be this time next week if we speak again?
I think we will be somewhere in Jordan. Probably in Syria.
Syria. Brilliant. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for speaking to us, Shakir, and we'll speak to you next week. Hopefully, you'll be in Syria.
Thank you.
Our next feature is from Anthea Page. It's a visit to the Midwinter Festival of Lights, organised by the Bristol Interface Group, which also coincided with the 61st anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights. But first, a carol. This is the Coventry Carol, which dates from the 16th century, and this carol was taken from a pageant presented by the Shearmen and Tailors of Coventry on the steps of the cathedral between 1534 and 1584. It was based on a much older morality play, and it's again performed by the American Percussion Ensemble.
Hi, I'm Valerie Emmett, and I'm the Vice Chair of the Bristol Interfaith Group. And every year in mid-December, we host an event here at Redland Meeting House called the Midwinter Circle. It's an evening of readings, stories, songs, and celebration of what all the different faiths of Bristol do at this time of year. And also, because it's midwinter, very often the theme is about light. Light in the darkness, and what we mean by light, both physical light and spiritual or metaphysical. One of the things that was important about this evening is today is the 61st anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And so in the midst of our discussion about light and these spiritual matters, we also made a point of talking about the fact that there are people who are still denied rights in our own city. And so there was a piece of tonight that was talking about how we rededicate ourselves to the ideal of being a city of welcome. In May, Bristol hopes to become named a city of sanctuary and welcome for people of all faiths, nationalities, and cultures. But the Bristol Interfaith Group exists, and it's been around for about 20, 25 years. It exists to bring people together for dialogue and conversation and interaction in a respectful way. No one is trying to convert anyone else. It's really more just to share with one another. As you can see around the table, people chatting over a vegetarian, non-alcoholic meal, and getting to know one another. I can see a pagan talking with a Unitarian, a Buddhist speaking with a Quaker, a person of no faith speaking with a pagan. So you've got people in this room who, if we didn't come together in this way, might not meet, might not have a chance to have those conversations which break down barriers between people.
Yeah. Where are you from in Bristol?
Easton. I'd just like to wish everyone Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah.
That was Anthea Page talking to participants from all religions at the Midwinter Festival of Lights held last week in Redland and organised by the Bristol Interface Group.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers.
Now for Tony Gosling's feature, it's the fifth and last part of The Strange Death of Dr. David Kelly.
How was it that we had such a ludicrous inquiry, a joke of an inquiry, which failed to do what any normal process would do? Answer, it was not a proper inquiry. It was not a statutory inquiry. It was a non-statutory inquiry Now, that may sound like a rather technical point, but it's actually terribly important. Lord Hutton was appointed with all due speed. For those of us who don't believe the government sometimes acts fast enough and takes a long time to do anything, take heart from the speed with which Lord Hutton was appointed. According to official event, Tony Blair was in the air on the way from America to Japan, more than halfway there, when he was told of the Dr. Kelly's body being found. This is the official version. He then spoke to Lord Falconer, the relevant minister, and to Alistair Campbell. It was decided that there ought to be an inquiry into Dr. Kelly's death. It was concluded that Lord Hutton would be the appropriate person to chair that. It was necessary to sound out the Master of the Rolls to see whether he was in agreement with that. It was then necessary for Lord Falconer to go to visit Lord Hutton to discuss the matter with him, at which the terms of reference would be agreed. Lord Hutton then had to agree the terms of reference and mull over the matter. He then had to agree. Lord Falconer had to appoint him, and it had to be reported back to the Master of the Rolls and to Tony Blair. And you know what? All this happened before Tony Blair actually landed in Japan. Astonishing speed with which the government can act when it wants to do so. But of course, what that did mean was that when the stories in the papers were written that day, they were written about the establishment of an inquiry, not about the circumstances surrounding David Kelly's death. A very convenient change of direction. Now, in this country, if you believe in the rule of law, we have something called a coroner's inquest. And when somebody suffers an unexplained or violent death, there is an inquest. That inquest is established under proper procedures, long-established proper procedures, at which, for example, people give evidence under oath, they can be subpoenaed to attend, and the normal safeguards of a court procedure will apply. The rules of cross-examination, for example, and the hurdles required to reach verdicts. For example, in a coroner's inquest, you have to be convinced beyond reasonable doubt, that's the hurdle, before you can bring in a suicide verdict. Beyond reasonable doubt. I just wind you back for the last 10 minutes and ask you whether you think this is beyond reasonable doubt in this case. But of course, we didn't have a coroner's inquest, because the Oxfordshire coroner, Nicholas Gardiner, began to look at the matter, as indeed he would. It was within his bailiwick, within his jurisdiction. But then what happened? Lord Falconer, a government minister, who'd been in touch with Tony Blair, of course, about Lord Hutton's appointment, told the Oxfordshire coroner he was being replaced in this matter by Lord Hutton. But the Oxfordshire coroner said, well, I'd like to carry on a bit further. But then Lord Falconer wrote to him and said, I'm bundling you off the case. You must stop your work now. I've got those details. I've got those letters because Harriet Harman very helpfully released them to me under the Freedom of Information Act. So we know what Lord Falconer wrote to the Oxfordshire coroner. It's all there in black and white. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not particularly comfortable with a government minister telling a coroner to get off the case when it's a significant death like this. But that's what happened on this particular occasion. And Lord Hutton was appointed. And Lord Hutton was appointed under the Coroner's Act 1988 under a provision which has been not very often used. Now, that provision was brought in by the then Conservative government for actually quite a sensible reason. Because when you have a situation such as, say, a train crash, and you have multiple deaths, all of which have the same cause, then it's actually more efficient and less heartrending for the individuals involved, the family members and so on, if the matter can be dealt with as one inquiry rather than having a series of repetitive inquests. So that provision was brought in to deal with that situation. On every occasion, there haven't been very many, it's been 4 or 5, on every occasion since then when that provision has been used, there have been multiple deaths, except for David Kelly's. And on every occasion when that's been used, the coroner's inquest has been replaced by another statutory process, such as the 1921 Tribunals Act, with the same legal safeguards, except in the case of David Kelly. And what we have with David Kelly was a non-statutory inquiry with as much legal formality as my talk to you here today. No more, no less than that. So Lord Hutton didn't have the ability to summon witnesses. He wasn't required to summon witnesses There were key witnesses who didn't attend. My Pedersen, who told us about David Kelly's aversion to swallowing tablets, who had information about his state of mind being his closest friend, who knew that he damaged his elbow and couldn't cut with a knife shortly before he died. Thames Valley Police told Lord Hutton she'd nothing of interest to tell him, so she wasn't called to give evidence. The police officer in charge of the inquiry, Alan Young, wasn't asked to give evidence. He didn't appear at the Hutton inquiry. He wasn't even mentioned. I found out afterwards he was a man in charge. We didn't even know he was there. Didn't know he existed until then. And other key people weren't invited to attend either. So we had a partial inquiry in terms of those who turned up. We had an inquiry where there was no proper cross-examination, as demonstrated by some of the many loose ends which had been left hanging. And we had a so-called inquiry where people were not under oath, they could not be subpoenaed, they could, if they wished to, lie with impunity. That is not a satisfactory way to deal with perhaps the most controversial and sensational death of this century, but that is what happened. And in addition to that, as I've mentioned earlier, Lord Hutton, in fact, spent relatively little time on David Kelly and a great deal more time on the BBC. That is a disgrace of a process and needs to be remedied. Now, there's one more thing about the coroner, because the coroner was effectively told that he did one last duty, which was to issue a death certificate. So he issued a death certificate which gave the reasons for death as incision of the ulnar artery and ingestion of coproximal tablets and potentially a complementary cause related to hardening the arteries or some heart condition, which, by the way, had not been picked up when David Kelly had had a medical shortly beforehand and it was unknown to his GP. That certificate was issued, I think, on the 14th of August 2003. Lord Hutton's inquiry had been in place for less than a week, and none of the evidence relating to David Kelly had been heard. So one might conclude, what was the point of Lord Hutton's inquiry if the death certificate had already established the cause of death? One might also conclude, what was the point of asking the coroner to issue the death certificate if Lord Hutton was about to look into the matter? Either way, that cannot be squared as a process. And I would suggest to you that the conclusion that Lord Hutton reached in his ludicrous and informal inquiry is, in legal terms, unsafe and cannot be sustained. So I'm in no doubt at the end of that, looking into all that, and I've only, frankly, touched the surface and with the matter today. There's a lot more detail in here, which is even more, I hope, compelling. I concluded at the end of that that there was no other conclusion that could be reached than that I had been murdered. It clearly wasn't suicide for the reasons I've given. It clearly wasn't a natural cause, and it clearly wasn't an accident. So that's the only explanation which you're left with. Now, that's a very uncomfortable conclusion to reach. It's also a rather dangerous conclusion to reach for someone who's a Member of Parliament, because it's outside the normal comfort zone which we operate in. Although many of my colleagues will tell me sotto voce they agree with me, they don't want to come out and say so very much publicly. It's a dangerous place to be in terms of political credibility. But I have to go with where the facts are. You can't disavow the facts. They are as they are.
Thank you very much to Tony Gosling for that feature on strange and mysterious death of Dr. David Kelly.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers.
Malcolm Greaves reads A Ghost Story for Christmas. Excellent. It's a reading of John Carrington's Wedding Day by Edith Nesbit.
John Charrington's Wedding by Edith Nesbit. No one ever thought that Mae Forster would marry John Charrington. But he thought differently, and things which John Charrington intended had a queer way of coming to pass. He asked to marry him before he went up to Oxford. She laughed and refused him. He asked her again next time he came home. Again she laughed, tossed her dainty blonde head, and again refused. A third time he asked her. She said it was becoming a confirmed bad habit, and laughed at him more than ever. John was not the only man who wanted to marry her. She was the belle of our village coterie, and we were all in love with her, more or less. It was a sort of fashion, like Masha collars or Inverness capes. Therefore we were as much annoyed as surprised when John Charrington walked into our little local club. We held it in a loft over the Saddlers, I remember, and invited us all to his wedding. Your wedding? You don't mean it. Who's the happy pair? When's it to be? John Charrington filled his pipe and lighted it before he replied. Then he said, I'm sorry to deprive you fellows of your only joke, but Miss Forster and I are to be married in September. You don't mean it. He's got the mitten again, and it's turned his head. No, I said, rising. I see it's true. Lend me a pistol, someone, or a first-class fare to the other end of nowhere. Charrington has bewitched the only pretty girl in our 20-mile radius. Was it mesmerism or a love potion, Jack? Neither, sir, but a gift you'll never have. Perseverance, and the best luck a man ever had in this world. There was something in his voice that silenced me, and all the chaff of the other fellows failed to draw him further. The queer thing was that when we congratulated Miss Forster, she blushed and smiled and dimpled for all the world as though she were in love with him, and had been in love with him all the time. Upon my word, I think she had. Women are strange creatures. We were all asked to the wedding. In Brixham, everybody who was anybody knew everybody else who was anyone. My sisters were, I truly believe, more interested in the trousseau than the bride herself, and I was to be best man. The coming marriage was much canvassed at afternoon tea tables, and at our little club over the Saddlers, and the question was always asked, does she care for him? I used to ask that question myself in the early days of their engagement, but after a certain evening in August, I never asked it again. I was coming home from the club through the churchyard. Our church is on a thyme-grown hill, and the turf about it is so thick and soft that one's footsteps are noiseless. I made no sound as I vaulted the low lichened wall and threaded my way between the tombstones. It was at the same instant that I heard John Charrington's voice, and saw her. May was sitting on a low, flat gravestone, her face turned towards the full splendour of the western sun. Its expression ended, at once and for ever, any question of love for him. It was transfigured to a beauty I should not have believed possible, even in that beautiful little face. John lay at her feet, and it was his voice that broke the stillness of the golden August evening. My dear, I believe I should come back from the dead if you wanted me. I coughed at once to indicate my presence, and passed on into the shadow, fully enlightened. The wedding was to be early in September. 2 days before, I had to run up to town on business. The train was late, of course, for we are on the South Eastern, and as I stood grumbling with my watch in hand, whom should I see but John Charrington and May Forster? They were walking up and down the unfrequented end of the platform, arm in arm, looking into each other's eyes, careless of the sympathetic interest of the porters. Of course, I knew better than to hesitate a moment before burying myself in the booking office, and it was not till the train drew up at the platform that I obtrusively passed the pair with my Gladstone and took the corner in a first-class smoking carriage. I did this with as good an air of not seeing them as I could assume. I pride myself on my discretion, but if John were travelling alone, I wanted his company. I had it. "Hello, old man," came his cheery voice as he swung his bag into my carriage. "Here's luck. I was expecting a dull journey." "Where are you off to?" I asked, discretion still bidding me turn my eyes away, though I saw without looking that hers were red-rimmed. "To old Branbridge's," he answered, shutting the door and leaning out for a last word with his sweetheart. "I wish you wouldn't go, John," she was saying in a low, earnest voice. "I feel certain something will happen." "Do you think I should let anything happen to keep me, and the day after tomorrow, our wedding day?" "Don't go," she answered with a pleading intensity which would have sent my Gladstone onto the platform and me after it. But she wasn't speaking to me. John Charrington was made differently. He rarely changed his opinions, never his resolutions. He only stroked the little ungloved hands that lay on the carriage door. "I must, May. The old boy's been awfully good to me, and now he's dying, I must go and see him. But I shall come home in time for..." The rest of the parting was lost in a whisper, and in the rattling lurch of the starting train. "You're sure to come?" she spoke as the train moved. "Nothing shall keep me," he answered, and we steamed out. After he'd seen the last of the little figure on the platform, he leaned back in his corner and kept silence for a minute. When he spoke, it was to explain to me that his godfather, whose heir he was, lay dying at Peasmarsh Place, some 50 miles away, and had sent for John, and John had felt bound to go. "I shall surely be back tomorrow," he said, "or if not, the day after, in heaps of time. Thank heaven, one hasn't to get up in the middle of the night to get married nowadays." "And suppose Mr. Branbridge dies?" "Alive or dead, I mean to be married on Thursday," John answered, lighting a cigar and unfolding the Times. At Peasmarsh Station we said goodbye, and he got out, and I saw him ride off. I went on to London, where I stayed the night. When I got home the next afternoon, a very wet one, by the way, my sister greeted me with, "Where's Mr. Charrington?" "Goodness knows," I answered testily. Every man since Cain has resented that kind of question. "I thought you might have heard from him," she went on, "as you ought to give him away tomorrow." "Isn't he back?" I asked, for I had confidently expected to find him at home. "No, Geoffrey." My sister Fanny always had a way of jumping to conclusions, especially such conclusions as were least favourable to her fellow creatures. "He has not returned, and what is more, you may depend upon it he won't. You mark my words, there'll be no wedding tomorrow." My sister Fanny has a power of annoying me which no other human being possesses. "You mark my words," I retorted with asperity. "You had better give up making such a thundering idiot of yourself. There will be more wedding tomorrow than ever you'll take the first part in." A prophecy which, by the way, came true. But though I could snarl confidently to my sister, I did not feel so comfortable when late that night I, standing on the doorstep of John's house, heard that he had not returned. I went home gloomily through the rain. Next morning brought a brilliant blue sky, gold sun, and all such softness of air and beauty of cloud as go to make up a perfect day. I woke with a vague feeling of having gone to bed anxious, and of being rather averse to facing that anxiety in the light of full wakefulness. But with my shaving water came a note from John, which relieved my mind and sent me up to the Forsters with a light heart. May was in the garden. I saw her blue gown through the hollyhocks as the lodge gates swung to behind me, so I did not go up to the house, but turned aside down the turfed path. "He's written to you too," she said, without preliminary greeting, when I reached her side. "Yes, I'm to meet him at the station at 3 and come straight to the church." Her face looked pale, but there was a brightness in her eyes, and a tender quiver about the mouth that spoke of renewed happiness. "Mr. Branbridge begged him so to stay another night that he had not the heart to refuse," she went on. "He is so kind, but I wish he hadn't stayed." I was at the station at 2:30. I felt rather annoyed with John. It seemed a sort of slight to the beautiful girl who loved him that he should come, as it were, out of breath and with a dust of travel upon him to take her hand, which some of us would have given the best years of our lives to take. But when the 3 o'clock train glided in and glided out again, having brought no passengers to our little station, I was more than annoyed. there was no other train for 35 minutes. I calculated that, with much hurry, we might just get to the church in time for the ceremony. But I would have fooled to miss that first train. What other man could have done it? That 35 minutes seemed a year as I wandered round the station reading the advertisements and the timetables and the company's bylaws and getting more and more angry with John Charrington. This confidence in his own power of getting everything he wanted the minute he wanted it was leading him too far. I hate waiting. Everybody does, but I believe I hate it more than anyone else. The 3:35 was late, of course. I ground my pipe between my teeth and stamped with impatience as I watched the signals. Click, the signal went down. 5 minutes later, I flung myself into the carriage that I had brought for John. "Drive to the church," I said, as someone shut the door. "Mr. Charrington hasn't come by this train." Anxiety now replaced anger. What had become of the man? Could he have been taken suddenly ill? I have never known him have a day's illness in his life. And even so, he might have telegraphed. Some awful accident must have happened to him. The thought that he had played her false never, no, not for a moment, entered my head. Yes, some terrible thing had happened to him, and on me lay the task of telling his bride. I almost wished the carriage would upset and break my head, so that someone else might tell her, not I, who... But that's nothing to do with this story. It was 5 minutes to four as we drew up at the churchyard gate. A double row of eager onlookers lined the path from lych gate to porch. I sprang from the carriage and passed between them. Our gardener had a good place near the door. I stopped. "Are they waiting still, Byles?" I asked, simply to gain time, for of course I knew they were by the waiting crowd's attentive attitude. "Waiting, sir? No, no, sir. Why, it must be over by now." "Over? Then Mr. Charrington's come?" "To the minute, sir. You must have missed it somehow. And I say, sir," lowering his voice, "I never see Mr. John the least bit so afore. But my opinion is he's been drinking pretty free. His clothes was all dusty and his face like a sheet. I tell you, I didn't like the looks of him at all. And the folks inside are saying all sorts of things. You'll see, something's gone very wrong with Mr. John and he's tried liquor. He looked like a ghost, and in he went with his eyes straight before him, and never a look or a word for none of us. Him that was always such a gentleman." I had never heard Byles make so long a speech. The crowd in the churchyard were talking in whispers and getting ready rice and slippers to throw at the bride and bridegroom. The ringers were ready with their hands on the ropes to ring out the merry peal as the bride and bridegroom should come out. A murmur from the church announced them. Out they came. Byles was right. John Charrington did not look himself. There was dust on his coat. His hair was disarranged. He seemed to have been in some row, for there was a black mark above his eyebrow. He was deathly pale. But his pallor was not greater than that of the bride, who might have been carved in ivory. Dress, veil, orange blossoms, face and all. As they passed out, the ringers stooped. And then, on the ears expecting the gay wedding peal, came the slow tolling of the passing bell. A thrill of horror at so foolish a jest from the ringers passed through us all. But the ringers themselves dropped the ropes and fled like rabbits out into the sunlight. The bride shuddered, and grey shadows came about her mouth. But the bridegroom led her on down the path where the people stood with the handfuls of rice. But the handfuls were never thrown, and the wedding bells never rang. In vain the ringers were urged to remedy their mistake. They protested with many whispered expletives that they would see themselves further first. In a hush, like the hush in the chamber of death, the bridal pair passed into their carriage, and its door slammed behind them. Then the tongues were loosed, a babel of anger, wonder, conjecture from all the guests and the spectators. "If I'd seen his condition, sir," said old Forster to me as we drove off,
I would have stretched him on the floor of the church, sir, by heaven I would, before I'd have let him marry my daughter.
Then he put his head out of the window.
Drive like hell, he said to the coachman. Don't spare the horses.
He was obeyed. We passed the bride's carriage. I forbore to look at it, and old Forster turned his head away and swore. We reached home before it. We stood in the doorway in the blazing afternoon sun, and in about half a minute we heard wheels crunching the gravel. When the carriage stopped in front of the steps, old Forster and I ran down.
Great heaven! The carriage is empty!
And yet I had the door open in a minute, and this is what I saw. No sign of John Charrington, and of May, his wife, only a huddled heap of white satin, lying half on the floor of the carriage and half on the seat. I drove straight here, sir, said the coachman, as the bride's father lifted her out, and I'll swear no one got out of the carriage. We carried her into the house in her bridal dress and drew back her veil. I saw her face. Shall I ever forget it? White, white and drawn with agony and horror, bearing such a look of terror as I have never seen since except in dreams. And her hair, her radiant blonde hair, I tell you, it was white, like snow. As we stood, her father and I, half mad with the horror and mystery of it, a boy came up the avenue, a telegraph boy. They brought the orange envelope to me. I tore it open. Mr. Charrington was thrown from the dog cart on his way to the station at 1:30, killed on the spot. And he was married to May Forster in our parish church at 3:30, in presence of half the parish. I shall be married, dead or alive. What had passed in that carriage on the homeward drive? No one knows. No one will ever know. Oh, May. Oh, my dear. Before a week was over, they laid her beside her husband in our little churchyard on the thyme-covered hill, the churchyard where they had kept their love trysts. Thus was accomplished John Charrington's wedding.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Greaves for that excellent reading of A Nice Ghost Story for Christmas by Edith Nesbit. Oh, and I'd like to welcome Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, to the studio, who's here once again with a poem. What have you got for us this week?
I'm dumbing down this week, John. Yeah, I've just got a little ditty about Tiger Woods, who's having a few problems at the moment, as you probably heard. Tiger Woods. People thought that Tiger didn't. Then it turned out that he did. They thought he was a cool cat, a clean living sort of kid. They thought that Tiger wouldn't. Then it turned out that he would, though tigers know they shouldn't. They have predatory blood. No one can tie a tiger down. It would be wrong to say we should. Young tigers like to paint the town as they feel it does them good. A leopard cannot change his spots or a tiger change his stripes. But when a cool cat gets the hots, who knows where he will strike? Yet a tiger has to face the flak if he gets his tackle out. Once spots are seen on a tiger's back, his credentials are in doubt.
Thank you very much. And let's hopefully hear more from the Bard of Windmill Hill in future weeks.
Thank you, John.
Studio guests, thank you to them all. We had three of them this week. Colin McNamee from the UKIP Party, Ali Zalmi as a journalist from the Kurdish region of Iraq, and Tim Hout from the Fisherman's Mission. Not forgetting, of course, our very own Bard of the Windmill Hill. Malcolm Greaves read excellently John Carrington's Wedding Day, A Christmas Ghost Story, and the features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. And the studio engineer was Mark Condon, and the producer was Anthea Page. So for myself, John Peters Coleman, take care and enjoy the festive period.